This is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug-bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
Yanni, before we start, can you retell me what you were saying earlier as a version of saying something's real big?
Oh, Tron.
Yeah.
I had a fellow tell me he called, he wished us good luck.
We're turkey hunting. But we're going to be turkey hunting with him.
Yes.
He's excited
about
it.
But he was in an earlier email.
Not that he's excited about with us, but he's excited about turkey.
No, he definitely wasn't excited about going with us because he's serious about it and he didn't want to be fiddle farting with us when he's out there trying to kill his Missouri bird.
So we're not going to hunt with him.
We may or may not, but he might already have one. You know, down by the time we get there because we're coming in for day three of the season. So these guys are going to have 2 days to start the season. Anyways, he was wishing us good luck and he was saying in an email, hey, if I can't, you know, if this doesn't work out, good luck killing a Missouri Gobbletron.
Yeah, and but I hadn't heard that and I don't like it. Not to besmirch or disparage the guy, but like, I don't like that. Because I just think of robots. A Tron? To add Tron on the end?
Yeah. And like maybe it's like AI turkey, so it's smarter than the regular turkey. Maybe that's what he's getting at, right? Like robotic, like artificial intelligence, maybe he's even smarter than the average turkey.
Because where I especially stopped liking it is when you said it's similar to saying something's Mondo.
Mm-hmm.
Or a toad.
Yeah.
What do you think?
We could go around the room.
If someone said to you, Dan, if they were like, hey, man, Gobbletron.
I would
good
have.
Good luck killing Gobbletron. Would you be like, what does that mean? Or you have an idea?
I would be like, what?
Yeah.
Do you mean something that's Mondo or something that's real shy? Mondo isn't even a word. We're hanging out with a guy who runs, he's a houndsman, and he had been doing a lot of work down in Mexico on research projects. So I thought that we would see a track and he'd be like, that's a Mondo track. And I thought it was a Spanish word. So I right away like that and I start picking up. And then in my head, everything that's big is Mondo.
But isn't that a system for shoe sizes too, though?
Mondo?
Isn't it?
Oh, that's not what he
meant.
Well,
Webster says, definition of Mondo, adverb, slang, extremely.
Huh. That's what I thought. So I thought that he was, well, not that. I thought he was speaking in Spanish. And I'm like, if there's a Spanish word that means a giant freaking track, I'm on that word. So I adopted before I even really cleared what he's saying. Then later I'm like, hey, man, what does Mondo translate to? And he looks at me like, what do you mean? And he goes, it's not Mondo, it's Mongo. You know, humongous. So that's what a Mondo track is.
Oh, you're right. So the whole time he was just saying Mongo.
Yeah, but we like ran with it, and we're like, Mondo is the way to go. Because I use toad, pig, biggin, big huge,
great,
giant.
Great biggin.
Bruiser.
Pig.
Hog.
Stomper.
Tron.
No. Yes, I wanted to touch on that. Now, one other quick order, because Dirt Myth is joining us here. And Dirt, you know, more people have been writing about your chewing tobacco problem. Do you care to have me give you a sum up of what their suggestions are?
Yeah, just for other listeners struggling with addiction, too.
Okay, one guy said there is...
One, for the betterment of everyone.
Another guy came and said to us, a guy wrote in to say that, in fact, you're wrong. And there is a chew that has no...
Oh, I saw that.
Yes.
It's just nicotine. Right? Is that what you're talking about?
But it doesn't have the... Is nicotine the part that makes your jaw fall off and you die?
Yeah. So that's
the part of it?
Yeah, and I have a buddy who did that. And those things, they're speaking of like AI or like technology... A thing that is just nicotine that you put in your mouth just seems, you know what I mean?
You don't
forget
like
what they're called, yeah. But I tried them.
It didn't help.
No, I mean, you catch your buzz, but, you know, old habits.
You still catch a nice little buzz.
Yeah, yeah. But I did see that. I think you shared that with me or someone Instagrammed it to me or something.
You know, Bryce and Joe, who we were just ice fishing with.
They're double downers.
Well, they chew grizzly. And so you put me in an uncomfortable situation because one day I was asking you, what kind of chew do you say? And you said, I have a good job. I don't chew Grizz. Yeah. I chew Copenhagen. So I saw that they had Grizz. And so knowing that you had told me this and I put a lot of faith in what you tell me, I said, oh, it's too bad you boys don't have good jobs. And it didn't go over real well. Yeah.
Well, no one wants to hear the truth, you know, sometimes.
And then Steve pointed out to them that although you have a good job, you're going to live out of your truck for a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's what someone else pointed out. Maybe he can't have that good of a job if he lives in his truck.
Well, you know,
if he lives at trailheads, if he's like a weird, like when you go to a trailhead, there's a weird guy living there.
That's don't dirt. Make it's eye contact
dirt.
With him.
It's probably dirt. If he's got a tin of Cope, then you know it's him.
Saving the rent for chew and adventures.
All right, before we move on to what we're here to talk about, I want to find out how much dirt's going to get out of this conversation. So name for me, if you can, the five species of Pacific salmon.
Okay.
That inhabit U.S. waters.
The layman's name or the...
Layman.
Okay.
Common name.
Yeah. Silver.
Yep.
Chum.
Yep.
Sockeye.
Yep.
Pink.
Yep.
Oh, man.
Biggins.
Oh,
Biggins.
Oh, King.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. Nice.
Nice job.
Yeah.
Now, name the one in the Atlantic. I gave you the answer.
When? The Biggin salmon?
Nope. I gave you the answer after that. It was buried within the question. It was like the other day when my daughter said to me, what's 1,002? Meaning, what happens when you add 1,002? And I was like, you just said it. What salmon lives in the Atlantic?
Is this the question you posed to me in the start? Because I was thinking of chew when you started the question.
No. Okay. I'm giving you the answer.
Okay.
What salmon lives in the Atlantic?
Oh, Atlantic salmon.
Yes.
So we got it? Yeah.
Yeah, no, we're good. So Dan, so that's Dirt Myth, and then Janice Poudelis is here. And then we're also speaking to my brother, Danny, who I mention all the time whenever fish comes up because fish biologist. Fisheries, what do you like to say?
Fish biologist, fisheries biologist.
But that involves a lot more than fish.
Yeah, I know. My current job title I'm working under is a fisheries biologist, but my background is pretty as well-rounded in aquatic ecology, and I've done work with a lot of work with habitat and aquatic insects and food webs and that sort of stuff. So
didn't it come out that your first kind of work was around aquatic invertebrates?
Yeah, that was kind of my path into fish. But yeah, I got really interested in them as an undergrad working on a fisheries degree. And the first part of my career was spent entirely on aquatic insects. I'm still fascinated with them, but now it's mostly just through the avenue of them being fish food.
Yeah. If you were going to, like, what percentage of your time do you spend thinking about and talking about issues having to do with salmon?
It's most of my time, most of my professional time.
And why is that? I mean, one, you like them, but is it because it's because there's an industry around it and so there's money to support it?
I mean, that's certainly part of it, but I mean, you have to do work that people care about, and you know, when you're working in Alaska, and I'm a freshwater biologist, I don't really, you know, operate on the marine end of things. In terms of Alaskan freshwaters, it's just you can't overstate the importance of salmon. You know, culturally, economically, ecologically, they're just incredible. They define Alaska.
Yeah, and you like to fish them too.
Oh, I love to fish them. Yes, yeah, it's some. One of my favorite things in the world, yeah.
And as Dirt pointed out so eloquently, there are five species of salmon on the Pacific coast of the U.S. And all five occur in Alaska.
Yes.
Yep.
Run through real quick what the five Pacific salmon are with like a kind of a basic sense of like what their groove is.
Okay. Yeah. Just in terms of how they.
And then what's up with the Atlantic salmon? Why is there only one over there?
So the five Pacific salmon, we have the pink or the humpy salmon.
Yeah, that's good too, because every salmon has two names, which is totally, it's like weird that it's that way.
Isn't there one that has more?
Oh, because there are different names, you know, down in the Northwest. I mean, you know, like Chinook salmon, they have different names in British Columbia, Washington. They have a million names, but
so pinks and humpies
within Alaska each has two that are sort of in common usage. Yeah, so pinks and humpies, and they are the smallest and most common of the salmon, and they have a sort of a
that's the most common salmon numerically.
Yeah, most numerically abundant of the salmon. They're just everywhere. When the pink salmon run, you've been seeing them in the, you know, when you're around the small coastal streams, like down around the fish shack or even up in here. But yeah, when the humpies are in, they're in thick, you know, and there's just thousands of them everywhere you go. And the whole place stinks like dead salmon. And they're just incredibly abundant. They have a short life history. Every pink salmon that is spawning in a creek is 2 years old. It was laid as an egg 2 years prior to that.
And that's set in stone.
Pretty much, yeah. So when you have a river that has a pink salmon run that returns in odd years and a pink salmon run that returns in even years, those are two completely separate populations of pink salmon, both with their own separate population dynamics. And
so one of those could plummet for whatever reason.
Oh, yeah. It's incredibly lopsided in some places. And I can't remember if it's odd or even, but like the Fraser River down in British Columbia. In 1 year, it gets, you know, millions and millions of pink salmon, and then the next year, it gets essentially none, and it just alternates every year like that.
So odd year, even year, you know it's going to be good or not good.
Yeah, yeah, and that shifts depending on geography. And over long time spans, it probably shifts, you know, within an area. An area might turn from a pink to from an odd to an even or whatever, you know.
But, yeah.
But some areas are pretty even and some areas are more lopsided, but they're really two separate populations.
Okay. So that's pinks and humpies. What's their Latin name?
Oncorhynchus. They're all Oncorhynchus.
That's how you pronounce it? Oncorhynchus?
Yeah, that's how I pronounce it at least, yeah. And the humpy is a gorbushka, I think is how it's pronounced.
It's Russian.
It's Russian, yes.
Oh.
Yeah, I believe so. I believe so. But pinks are, life history wise, as with all of the Pacific salmon, they are spawned in the sort of late summer or fall. And the eggs incubate sort of into the winter and hatch kind of maybe late winter, early spring. And pink salmon, upon hatching, and they absorb the yolk and emerge from the gravel, and they leave the river. They just migrate to fresh water right after they hatch.
They don't linger.
They don't linger. No.
And why do pinks don't run long distances?
No, a lot of them spawn sort of in intertidal areas and low in river systems. They're just adapted using that part of the watershed. Yeah.
They might run a couple hundred yards.
Yeah. You see them spawning in intertidal areas on that freshwater lens. You know, they'll migrate into the estuary, then drop back out as the tide ebbs and flows. Yeah.
And when they come out of their egg, they're right out in the ocean.
Yeah. Well, they come out of the egg and they still have a little yolk attached, right? And once that yolk is absorbed, then at that point, their jaws are fully developed and they start feeding sort of on their own. And by that point, yeah, those pinks are just following the current. And they sort of time their hatching to other emergence to coincide with sort of the spring runoff, and they just kind of follow that down to the ocean.
When a salmon's eggs are laying there, like the salmon, their eggs, like take a pink for instance, his eggs don't stick to the rock.
No,
they're just laying like in sheltered areas out of the current between rocks.
No, they're actually buried. I mean, the female excavates the nest or the red, and she lays the eggs there, and they're fertilized, and then she'll actually bury them under gravel.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You see them digging out, but I didn't know that. So they really cover them up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The ones that aren't covered aren't going to make
it. She'll dig a pocket and then, you know, scoot upstream a little bit and dig another one, and that kind of falls back on the previous pocket, and she sort of digs a series of these pockets and lays eggs in them and then buries them as she goes along.
Got you. So march along to the next
thing. Hold on. So when does the male come in?
As she, those eggs are fertilized as she's dropping them.
Really?
Yeah. You can see it in a creek. Yeah. You'll see them. They'll sort of sandwich up side by side, and they'll open their jaws and even kind of quiver a little bit, you know, and like that's the action right there.
The whole face.
Yeah. But I didn't know. Like,
you can even see the milk drifting down the current. Because
when you see a male, like when you see a female laying, you see her like the way.
No, that's digging.
That's digging.
Yes.
Because I was saying this the other day, like when we used to fish steelhead, you'd be staring into a place where you know steelhead hang out.
Yeah.
Couldn't tell if there any there. And you'd catch the female flash.
That flashing is the digging. She's like laying on her side. And picture like if you put your hand on the bottom in the rocks and you lifted it up, you'd create some suction, right? And that would kind of pull the rocks up. That's what she's doing with her whole body.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I pictured it. I didn't know this. I had in my head my whole life here that they lay the egg down and the male comes and somehow fertilizes the sitting egg. But they need to do it in tandem.
Yeah. It's happening all at once.
Can you real quick talk about, before we get back to the other ones, can you talk about when you, like the act of fertilizing, when you're like doing artificial insemination of salmon eggs in a bucket?
Uh-huh.
I remember you saying one time that you saw where there's like a 5-gallon bucket of eggs.
Yeah.
And someone would put in like a tablespoon.
Yeah. Stuff shockingly potent. Yeah.
A tablespoon.
Like a squirt, right? Like, yeah.
Like a squirt of semen, stir that bucket up with a ladle, a spoon, and be like, that bucket is fertilized.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, this was in some little hatchery experience I had in my undergraduate days. But yeah, they would take a bucket of salmon eggs and take they would just squirt. I think they would use a few males to make sure that they had, you know, a good viable one and maybe a little diversity. But just a little squirt of sperm from each of those fish into a big bucket of eggs, stir it up, and they're good to go.
Ready to roll.
Yeah.
Okay, march on to the next fish. Up in size. Let's go from smallest to most mondo.
Sorry, I got to interrupt. I feel like we can't leave the humpy until we talk a little bit about, like, why does he get that funny shape when he comes back in there?
Yeah, we can do that. But I was planning on coming back with some other issues. But okay. Yeah, why not talk about why they call them humpies? Why do they call them humpies?
So the humpy term refers to the big kind of humped back that the male male pink salmon gets during spawning.
And his crazy hook jaw.
Yes. And so, yeah, those are secondary sexual characteristics, I guess, analogous to the ornamentation on a bird or something like that. They're just demonstrating the hump makes them look bigger and more opposing, and the hook jaw makes them look rougher and tougher. And they use that to display and for aggression to compete for females, you know, with other males.
So that's him getting tricked out,
getting pimped out and ready to spawn. Yeah.
Do you know, like, are you familiar with the late geneticist Stephen Jay Gould?
Yes, a little.
He had a point he made one time in one of his books I was reading where he's kind of getting at something I'm sure you deal with and talk about all the time. Would be that, like, we don't know why things become the way they become. And he was using an example like someone might look and be like, wow, bark, right? Bark is brown. What's the genetic, what's the selective advantage of brown bark? Like,
yeah.
Why is it brown? Like, what is the tree gaining from having brown bark? And he would say, maybe what the tree is doing is that there's an advantage to having very thick bark.
Something structural in that.
Because it can resist forest fire. So the advantage is the thickness of bark. As over the years, it's selected for thicker and thicker bark. It just so happens for maybe perhaps no advantageous reason at all that it's attains a certain color.
Yeah.
But we look and ponder over the color, thinking like, why is it that way when it's just, there's no reason it's that way.
It's like green leaves. There's nothing special about that color. It's just.
Yeah, the tree isn't gaining from having green leaves.
The color is a byproduct of some other
evolutionary. But in this case, it does seem like, maybe some other reason, like why they get a big hump and a hook jaw. Or is it so like obvious that it has to be that it has that because it's like a competitive, selective?
It's so many other species have, you know, sort of, well,
a breeding,
similar types of secondary sexual traits that come out during breeding. And, you know, salmon live for multiple years. Those traits don't appear until, you know, right at the time of spawning.
And it makes sense because it's a competitive environment. He's jockeying for favor.
Yeah, exactly. And it fits with their mating structure. Yeah, I mean, it makes sense.
And it probably takes some amount of energy to do it.
Oh, for sure. For sure. It's a trade-off. Yeah. Yeah.
Are fish, is it true, can you say generally that, like, fish are like birds where the males do a lot more ornamentation? They're flashier?
Man, I'm still in the salmon world for a while. I think so. And parental care tends to be males, and ornamentation tends to be males.
Females
in that regard, unlike birds, because the parental care among the fishes tends to be fall more on the males. But in terms of ornamentation, yeah, I think so.
And then with the salmon, are the males all bigger than the females?
No, I don't think so. That's a good question. I think it's the females on average tend to be a little bigger.
Tend to be a little bit heavier than the males.
I think so.
So when you catch a big, huge king.
It could be either sex. Yeah.
Yeah, gotcha.
Yeah.
All right, you cool on that?
I'm cool.
Man, I think at the top end, I can picture some big males, but on average, the females might be a little bigger. They tend to be a little older.
On what species?
Just salmon in general. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, the pinks are always coming back at two.
Well, I shouldn't say that. Not pinks. The others. Yeah.
The other ones.
The ones we haven't got to yet.
The ones we'll get into.
Yeah.
So what's the next one?
Let's just moving up the. So I mean, you can think of pink salmon as being, you know, quite marine, right? Right, because they. Spend relatively little time in freshwater. And so chum salmon have sort of a similar life history in that they...
Well, that's a good observation. They don't spend... Like, they have to have the fresh water, but they just don't spend any time there.
They only use it for breeding. Yeah, I mean, as soon as that... as soon as the fry emerges from the gravel, like, they can handle salt water right away, which... You know, the other salmon sort of have a more involved transformation, and they're out of there. Yeah.
So he's dead. They all die when they're two.
Mm-hmm.
And he could have spent a week in freshwater.
As a free swimming fish.
As a free swimming fish.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, chum salmon have a somewhat similar life history in that they go to sea soon after emerging from the gravel. A lot of chum salmon are also spawned sort of coastally low in the watershed, but there are some chum salmon populations like the Yukon River in Alaska, for example, where chum salmon move a really long way up rivers.
You didn't say the two names for chums.
Chum salmon and dog salmon would be the two. I'm sure there are others, but those are the two that are in common usage in Alaska. Where they deviate from pink salmon is that chum salmon can spend multiple years rearing in freshwater. I think
multiple years.
I'm sorry, in saltwater.
Okay,
so they leave freshwater soon after emerging, typically in the spring of the year, and they can spend multiple years at sea. I think 2 and 3 years is pretty common for them.
So with pinks, I want to go step back to pinks for a minute. Because when pinks, like, if you catch a big male, or big whatever, you catch a big specimen who's, like, obviously bigger than the other ones, there's nothing, he's not older.
He's older.
He went to a better place in the ocean.
Yeah, or he's just, you know, there's a lot of variation in sort of aggressiveness, tolerance for risk, and those sorts of things over the span of 2 years can result in fish of different sizes, yeah.
Yeah. And a chum can choose to stay another year.
Yeah, and that's a good way to put it, because it sort of is a decision that they make every year when they're rearing in the ocean. Basically, they decide, well, am I going to spawn this year or am I going to wait another year?
What is that like? I know we're using decision, but what does that look like?
You know, it seems to be related to the foraging conditions and how rapidly they're growing. And if they are, when that decision window comes, if they're in good condition and growing rapidly, they're more inclined to spawn at a younger age. So sort of paradoxically, like, you know, for a given species, a bigger salmon tends to be an older salmon, and it was one that was sort of growing at a slower rate and it took longer to get big.
When does that that trigger or decision happen for a salmon?
Is that
not well understood?
You know, it's not really my area. But I can speculate that, you know, probably late winter, springtime, you know, they're out in the Pacific somewhere and it's either time to turn and start heading home or not, you know,
and so they and need to have your body start like making the eggs.
Yeah, exactly. To mature sexually. And yeah, exactly. So, they need to allow some time for that. So it's not a last minute sort of game time decision.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause you're like takes months to develop them.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, in general, with chums or whatever, how far out into the ocean do they go?
Way out, like all the way out.
All of them.
Yeah. I mean, they're overlapping in their ocean distribution. North American, salmon in general, Chinook tend to be a little more coastal, king salmon, but the others, they're overlapping with Asian fish and they're all intermingled out in the middle of the Gulf and out in the middle of the North Pacific. And
so like a salmon who might otherwise go into North Korea or is going to Siberia
is interacting at sea with our fish. Yes. Yeah.
Wow, man, I didn't know that. Really?
Yeah.
But a king might be more of a homebody.
They tend to stick closer. I mean, they tend to stick closer to the coast. Yeah. Yeah. And you think about the fisheries, right? Like, people catch along the coast of Alaska and presumably for themselves, people catch king salmon year round.
Winter kings. They call it the black mouth season.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, there aren't any coho inshore
there's no winter coho.
Yeah, there's no winter coho fishery. Or there's no chum salmon inshore. There are king salmon in coastal waters all the time.
When you say interact with these other salmon out there, is it like one school passes by the other school? Or is it like all of a sudden they're like, hey, let's all get together and feed together for a few days?
That's a good question. I don't know.
No one knows that yet.
I don't know. Maybe judging by how some people that sort of engage in that sort of research might see, you know, if they're hooking fish or gill netting or whatever, they may see that they're intermingled with fish of Asian origin or whatever, but I'm not that familiar with that.
On that same note, do they ever bump into each other in spawning, same spawning sources?
No, because at that point they are going to their home stream.
And there won't be two species in the same home stream.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, yeah.
But different timing.
But what he was saying is there was fish coming out of Asia and then coming out of North America that when they're out there growing, they might be swimming around together. Oh,
yeah. Like they go so far out into the ocean
that they,
they're competing with each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that doesn't happen with a... Oh, I got you.
No,
because they split up.
Think about dirt. Because if they came all back to the same place, they would cease to be different, of different origins.
Yeah, I'm saying, though, that each subspecies, there's never a case where...
These aren't subspecies.
Or not subspecies. Each species wouldn't come from the same, you know, freshwater source. Like, there wouldn't be pinks and chum coming from the same, like, freshwater spawning ground.
Oh yeah, for sure. They do. Yeah.
And will they like run into each other at that phase?
Are you saying this, Dirt? Are you saying that do pinks and chums intermingle out in the high seas?
Opposite in the spawning, like back at theirs where they, you know,
they'll be in the river at the same time.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. They're choosing like different types of habitat and stuff, but they can certainly overlap during the at the timing of their spawning. Yeah.
Is there, and what made me ask that is like, do they ever, is there ever, I don't know if crossbreeding is
hybridizing.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think that's pretty rare in the native range of salmon, but in the Great Lakes, I know that it's not uncommon there. I've seen in the Great Lakes where several species of Pacific salmon have been introduced, I have seen hybrids of king salmon and pink salmon.
Okay, yeah. That's
really?
What I was curious.
So. Kinks. Kinky.
It looks like a great big humpy.
Does it?
Yeah.
Yeah, just because the way that they are, you know, like you're saying, that so much eggs and so much sperm. Like,
it's think, all mixed in there.
Yeah, man, like big old fish orgy.
Yeah, they're all spawning roughly the same time of year.
But interesting.
But in the, in the native range, it happens.
Not common.
Yeah, not common.
All right, dogs and chums. They tend to not go far into the rivers.
But there was some very serious exceptions, yeah.
Like the ones that'll go
thousands
miles.
Of kilometers at least up the Yukon, yeah. And other rivers.
Okay. And pinks are never found up there.
No. Pinks will go a little ways in, you know, miles, tens of miles, maybe hundreds of miles, but not thousands, yeah.
I would invite the listener to go pull up a map of North America and ponder for a moment. Look at the Yukon. So, like, you can imagine, like how big Alaska is, okay? Biggest state. If you center Alaska over a map with the lower 48, you kind of, like, wind up centering Alaska, you know, around Iowa or so. And southeast Alaska goes way down into Texas. I think the Aleutians go out to the California coast.
Oh, southeast Alaska is like Georgia and down in there. Yeah.
It's just huge. But look at a map of North America and ponder for a moment that fish entering the Yukon. So the Yukon kind of like cuts Alaska in half, east to west, and flows out in western Alaska. That salmon that are entering the Yukon at the coast are spawning in Canada.
Yeah. And the United States has a treaty with Canada dictating how many salmon we're going to let swim through the border.
It's an enormous journey.
Yeah. I don't know how many miles it is at that point, but it's a lot. Yeah.
And that's chums. And real quick, back up, because there's the thing I wanted to touch on. The sort of like economic value. Or, you know, the table fare value. Chums are low man on the totem pole of the five salmon. The least well-regarded from a food perspective.
Oh, I guess so. And I can speak more as an Alaskan and someone who, you know, eats a lot of salmon and has a lot of conversations about salmon and is like sort of steeped in salmon culture. But yeah, and I don't think there's a great market for them either. But I mean, I think the reason they have the nickname dog salmon is because it's, you know, it's often dog food, even still today. And yeah, pink salmon are pretty low regard in terms of food value too, at least among Alaskans.
A lot of them wind up in cans.
Yeah. But there's an industry around canned pink salmon, and a lot of that goes to Europe and England in particular.
And the color on a pink salmon, it might be why they call them pink salmon.
I think that's what that refers to.
The flesh is pink,
yeah,
not red.
Yeah. And chums are...
And like reds have red flesh.
Very red. Yeah, very red appetizing flesh. Yeah. And yeah, chum salmon don't have great color. And they tend to have low fat content because they're not undergoing a long freshwater migration. And so it kind of keeps the demand down and the price down. They have big eggs, though, and they're fish commercially. A lot of their commercial value is in the roe, most of which gets exported.
Which probably goes to markets in Asia.
Yep.
Okay, what's the next salmon?
Let's go to sockeye.
Reds? Reds or sockeyes?
Yep, reds or sockeyes. So similar type of life history pattern. They're anadromous, and the adults return from the ocean to their natal river, or in the case of sockeye, lakes. They are strongly associated with lakes, and spawning occurs often in or near lakes.
So they go up a river to get to a lake.
Yes, yes, exactly right. And they're so like we talked about with pinks and chums, after they emerge from the gravel, those two head to sea. Sockeye, for the most part, head to a lake. And so the spawning occurs like along the beaches and lakes, in some cases where there's upwelling or sort of wind-driven kind of currents. Or they'll spawn in feeder streams or even outlet streams. And those fish are sort of genetically programmed to know where that lake is and head for that lake once they hatch, be it upstream or downstream from their particular location. And they spend a year or two in most, or a year or two rearing in that lake.
In a lake?
In a lake, yep.
And they get how big in the lake?
Oh, what is...
What's that? 2.5 inches long?
80, 100 millimeters, I think. Just roughly. Yeah, a few inches.
What's the advantage there? So then he spends a year or two in a freshwater lake, and then he's like, now I will go to the ocean.
Now, yeah, exactly. Exactly, yeah.
And what's the advantage of that?
Probably just, it's just a niche they filled, you know? They're in that lake, and they're, in, you know, instead of, well, we'll talk about how king salmon and Saka and coho salmon sort of make a living as juveniles in the river, but they've just sort of adapted this lifestyle where they're living in a lake, and they feed on plankton in the water column. They're sort of a pelagic fish for a couple years.
But at some point, their needs become too great, and they go to sea.
Yeah, it's at some point they sort of in an evolutionary sense, they've made the decision that they can grow a lot faster by migrating to the ocean. The marine environment is much more productive. There's a lot more food out there. When they reach a size that is big enough that they're not going to get eaten the moment they poke out there, right?
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a balance. How long do you stay in freshwater? But when they reach a certain size, they'll head to the ocean. They're big enough to survive. I mean, the survival rate's very low, regardless of how big these fish are when they're migrating. But yeah, they get to a certain size, ahead of the ocean, they take their chances there, because the return is potentially, you know, huge in terms of the potential for the forage base is much larger.
And how long does a red or a sockeye go out to sea for?
They're rather variable, but I would 2 to 4 years, I think, is pretty common.
And they come back weighing about what? Like, just from a fishing perspective, like, oh, how big are they?
Pound-wise, like, you know, maybe 3 to 6 or 8 pounds is pretty common, just guessing.
And then two quick things. Can you explain, like, what a kokanee is?
So, yeah, a kokanee is a landlocked sockeye salmon. So it's a population of sockeye salmon that lives in a lake that, for whatever reason, they don't go to the ocean. Either they've sort of, you know, made that decision not to go, or they're somehow blocked.
And there are natural populations, because there's a lot of introduced populations, yes, of kokanee, but they, yes, come from natural populations that somehow, through some cataclysmic, yeah, event, presumably.
No, I don't think kokanee are necessarily blocked from going to the ocean. It's sort of just life history decision.
So there are kokanee populations that could go to the ocean.
Yeah, they stay in lakes. They spin off from that lake's sockeye population and just become kokanee. Just, I mean, you can think of it the same way as some resident rainbow trout populations have spun off the steelhead population.
Gotcha.
And just stay put.
So the opposite happened there.
Yeah.
And then, but kokanees are dinky, though.
Yeah, they don't get big because, I mean, they reach sexual maturity at a small size because they're in that lake environment. But compare that to how big an ocean sockeye is. That just shows you the difference in growth potential between those two environments.
That it's worth the gamble.
Yeah.
And then sockeyes will do some mega migrations or no?
They use the whole North Pacific, yeah.
No, I mean, when they go up a river, they'll shoot.
Yeah, I mean, they're really attached to lakes. So if you have a river system that has a lake, you know, way, way, way upstream. What's Redfish Lake in Idaho? That's an interesting example. I don't know how far inland that is, but it was a sockeye population all the way in Idaho.
They're going up the Columbia.
Columbia and then
into the Clearwater or whatever.
Yeah, I can't. Yeah.
And then that fish, talk about this for a minute, because like that fish is a fatty fish, right?
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure about.
Well, here's the question. Here's the question I want to ask. Why do some people think there's a salmon called a Copper River salmon? Like, as its own species, sort of.
Well, it's more of a brand than a species, yes. But yeah. But so, you know, there's, in lots of ways, salmon adapt to their, you know, they're really a product of their river, and they adapt to their specific river. And, you know, so in the case of, well, I mentioned earlier, fat content is sort of an adaptive trait of salmon, and it relates to, you know, once salmon begin their freshwater migration, they stop feeding and they live on their fat reserves, and fish that are destined for a spawning ground that's further up some river tend to put on a little more fat than fish that are spawning lower in the watershed. So the Copper River being a relatively large watershed with some, you know, in terms of sockeye, some somewhat long migrations, they tend to be a little fatter. And people certainly value that.
The fatty content.
Yeah, yeah. And the comparison that's often made, you know, in South Central Alaska is to that of the Kenai salmon. The Kenai River is another really popular local sockeye salmon fishery, and the migration, the freshwater migration there isn't quite as long, and some people at least regard those fish as being less fatty and less flavorful. But there's probably some data on it. I'm not familiar with it, though.
Can you real quick explain the dip net fishery that you engage in?
Yeah, so Alaska residents are allowed to participate in a number of fisheries that are called personal use fisheries, where they let you do some things that would be considered poaching pretty much anywhere else. So there are a few in South Central Alaska: the Copper River, the Kenai River, the Kasilof River, and sometimes some others. These are mostly focused on sockeye salmon, but the state opens it up for locals to fish with dip nets. And a dip net is defined as basically a landing net with a hoop up to 5 feet in diameter. So they're potentially very large nets. And people will line up along a beach and waders with these nets in the water, or in some cases fish from a boat and sort of tow these nets downriver. You got to hold them in your hand. And you're allowed a generous supply of salmon for your family.
Like it might be 15 sockeyes for the head of household.
25 right now. So I think the Kenai and the Copper are managed separately with separate limits, but you're allowed a 25 for the head of the household and 10. This is an annual limit, and then 10 fish for each member of the household. So my family would be allowed 55 salmon from each of those rivers. That's far more than we need. But, yeah, we head out dip netting and get some fish, yeah.
Like up to your ankle deep in the boat fish.
Yeah, yeah. But, it's nice to be able to go out in one shot, get a whole bunch of salmon and, you know, take good care of them, get them in the freezer and be done with it, you know.
Yeah, yeah, and then can them.
Can them, freeze them. Yeah, different people do different things with them. But
do you still mess around with your steel canner?
You know, I haven't used that in years. I want to get it out, though, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about, Yanni? He bought, like, a thing to make a home jobby to make steel cans instead of glass jars.
Yeah, it just crimps the lid on the can is what it does, and then you still process it in the canner, you know.
That thing's pretty sweet.
It is cool. Yeah, I need to.
I remember you made me a teal duck in a can.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so that's the sockeye. And the sockeye is the earliest. He runs quicker than anybody, right? In the spring, in the summer.
Oh, that run timing all depends on where you're at.
Yeah. Oh, it does.
But around here, yeah, the king salmon and sockeye tend to be the earliest.
June?
Even May for king salmon in some places, they're starting. Yeah. June and July for sockeye around here. And then, yeah, later in June and into July, the, pinks and chums start showing up. And then pretty much probably everywhere in Alaska, the coho or the silvers tend to be the latest.
Let's move on to the next one. So we've covered pinks. Pink's humpies, chum's dogs, red sockeyes.
Mm-hmm. Coho Silver.
That's the next one.
Yeah, we'll save the king for last. Yeah. So, yeah, Coho or Silver. They're cool salmon. The thing I like about them is that they're sort of an aggressive and a sporty salmon. They like to chase flies and they like to hit lures, and they run every little trickle. There's just coho everywhere. And yeah, you can fish them just about anywhere. They're a great eating salmon. They're kind of like, yeah, just like the everyman salmon, you know, they run all over the place. In terms of life history, obviously anadromous, spawn in, so a little bit later in the year, they're more in, at least around here, they're more of a fall spawner, September, October. They eggs overwinter in the gravel, they emerge in the spring, but unlike all the others we've talked about up to this point, the coho then spends two years typically in Alaska, 2 years rearing in a stream. They don't go to a lake like the Saco or go to sea like the Pinks.
So he gets how big?
About 100 millimeters or so.
Same thing.
Yeah.
A 3-inch fish.
Yeah, yeah. And so in Alaska, it takes a couple years to do that. Sometimes you'll see them taking a little longer. A few of them go out after 1 year. But
so most you think
them,
you're looking at a dinky little trout, but it's a coho.
Yeah, I mean, if to the casual observer, it would look like a small rainbow trout or something. Yeah, yeah.
And then goes out to the ocean and lives out in the ocean for how long?
1 year.
That's it?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So when you're catching 12-pound silvers, those are a year old?
Yeah.
No, they're 3 years old.
Yeah, 1 year.
Been out in the ocean.
1 year at sea.
Oh, I'm sorry.
1 year at sea. Yeah.
So he spends way more of his life in freshwater than he does in saltwater.
Yes. Yeah. In Alaska, I think further south, they tend to more commonly spend 1 year in freshwater. But.
And that's a good eating fish, but not everybody admits how good they are.
You say not everybody?
I feel like there's some guys that are like kind of down on silvers.
Some guys will only eat a king. Yeah.
There's like sockeye king guys.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to ask, are the sockeyes and the cohos roughly, usually for the average Alaskan that fishes, are they considered to be equals?
Yeah, I think people sometimes do different things with them too. Like sockeye hold up to canning really well, you know, so a lot of people home can. I think the color on that, the sockeye is really appealing too. You know, it's a really pretty fillet when you take it out of the freezer too.
But there can't be as many, nearly as many tons of silvers harvested commercially.
No. As sockeye? No, no. Sockeye are, in areas where you have rivers with lakes on them, these sort of lake systems, then sockeye are incredibly abundant. And those are, you know, the big dollar salmon fisheries in Alaska. The big dollar commercial salmon fisheries here are sockeye fisheries.
Here's a quick one to throw us off the sequence that we're going through, but how many years would you have to go back to find a common ancestor, and would you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, it's in the millions, maybe like, I want to say 6 to maybe 10 or 15 million years, I think, like that. The five salmon that we're talking about had all differentiated by about 6 million years ago.
What the hell was that fish's groove, man?
I don't know. And then going further back, the Atlantic salmon peeled off the Pacific salmon line. There's a common ancestor there, too.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Like all the different weather changes and stuff that have happened?
Yeah. So, I think you brought this up earlier, but, there's a theory out there that, you know, all that speciation in, you know, where you have one species of Atlantic salmon but five different Pacific salmon, that has to do with all the topographical diversity around the Pacific Rim and the uplift of mountain ranges and things, segregated habitats and created opportunities for divergent evolution and
speciation. Like those fish can go and experience so many different kinds of.
Yeah, yeah. But then, you know, around the sort of the Atlantic rim, you never hear that term, but it doesn't have the, you know, the all the mountain uplift and the potential for habitat fragmentation.
It's a little more homogenous.
Yeah, yeah. That's the thinking on that anyway.
That's interesting. So the last one, did we give the silver coho its due?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
You kind of finished on just saying how we kind of got all excited when we realized that he's only in the ocean for a year.
He's going out in the ocean at 3 inches, and a year later he comes back as a 12, 15, 16.
Yeah, they grow fast. And it's really interesting. Like, you know how, you know, we catch silvers around the cabin in the salt water, and that's like some of my favorite fishing ever. You know, I absolutely love it. But those fish are packing on like a pound a week when they're sort of in the inshore, like on the last bit of their sort of pre-spawn migration as they're moving through those channels in Southeast Alaska and presumably other places, you know, as they're nearing maturity, they're feeding like crazy and just packing on weight.
Hey, you know, we haven't touched on the different fish. Do they tend to target different stuff out in the ocean?
I know a little bit about that. Chinook salmon tend to be a little higher on the food web. They're eating more fish, fewer invertebrates. Sockeye tend to be consuming more invertebrates, less fish. I think pink and chum are a little lower, you know, a little more invertebrate in their diet, less fish.
And like kings will go out and eat squid and stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think all of them would eat a squid given the opportunity. Gotcha. I mean, they're all generalists, but they have their own sort of preferences.
Yeah. Okay, so kings, chinooks. What the hell's the word chinook? It's got to be a native word.
Oh, yeah, from where? I don't know.
Is coho a native word, you think?
I don't know. It's a good question.
Silver, like when you talk about a coho or silver, the silver has to refer to the side of that fish.
Yeah, I can't imagine that.
It looks like it's chrome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like made out of chrome. It's like made out of stainless steel.
Double dip chrome.
Yeah. So a chinook. Probably a native word. King being he is the big bad mofo of the
king
salmon.
Of salmon. Yeah,
he's the bad mofo of the salmon world. So, what's their basic rundown?
Quite similar to that of the coho.
They'll hang out in the freshwater.
Yeah, here most of the king salmon in Alaska spend a year in freshwater. And then several years in saltwater is how that goes.
That's why they get so big.
Yeah. Yep.
They'll go out for several years.
3-4 is pretty common. 5 certainly happens.
So when someone catches a giant, is it likely that that just meant he was out longer? Yeah. Or was he just doing the right thing and not making a mistake?
It's a little bit of both, but yeah. I think like a really hog king salmon has been out there a while, 4 or 5 years.
But then... That's what you kind of mentioned this, like the sort of paradox. So that means that there was a handful of times when his body felt that it wasn't right.
Quite ready, yeah.
It wasn't right. It wasn't getting what it needs, and so it postpones its spawning run, but then turns into some 50, 60-pound fish.
That's exactly right, yeah. If he was really kicking ass, he would have came back. He would have went to sea and came back that summer as a jack. If they're really growing fast, sometimes they don't even leave the river.
So does a jack die when it spawns?
Yeah.
Every salmon we've talked about dies when it spawns.
Yes. Yes. Pacific salmon, well, it gets a little squirrely because of the steelhead here, which is sort of technically a Pacific salmon, but that's the only one that will live to spawn again.
And a steelhead is a rainbow trout. I mean, this is in layman's terms. It's a rainbow trout that goes to the ocean for some of its life.
It's an anadromous rainbow trout, yeah. It's in the same genus as the Pacific salmon.
But a steelhead can spawn multiple times.
Yes. Yeah, but Pacific salmon always spawn after they die.
Atlantics can go back to the ocean?
Yes. Yes.
It's not a death sentence to spawn.
No. No. I mean, a lot of them die.
But what is the advantage of the dying?
So the advantage of the dying is it's a trade-off. They're basically committing all of their resources to one reproductive event. so they can make more eggs, bigger eggs. They can defend their nest. They're just plowing it all into one event at the expense of any future potential spawning.
Going for broke.
They're just going for broke. Exactly right. In an evolutionary sense, yeah.
And if like that works for them, why did it not work? It's just like, why is it being so weird? Like, why did it not work for Steelhead?
Yeah, they're operating in a different, yeah.
A good time machine question would be to go back more toward that, like the common ancestor. What was that fish's groove?
Yeah, what's the ancestral trait there? Yeah.
Was the whole dying thing a later, like something that came around later, or have they been doing that, the dying trick for a long time?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question.
Are the Are the Atlantic salmon, do they have traits more similar to that initial, like before the split of the species, in that they can spawn multiple times and that they didn't have the, like you said?
Yeah, that's a good question. Range. I'm not sure that's something you can derive from the fossil record, like, yeah, you know, things about the nuances of behavior, you know, so yeah, there's not a lot of salmon fossils to begin with. So, somebody might know the answer to that, but not me.
Why are dams so bad for fish?
They impact the habitat in a lot of ways, but the most obvious is that they block migration.
That is the most obvious
upstream and downstream. And they convert a big chunk of river to a pond, you know, and you get a whole set of predators that tend to live in those ponds, right? And then when you have juvenile fish on their seaward migration, then they're used to sort of riding the spring melt plume out to the ocean, and they're making that journey. And
like taking a lickety-split trip.
And all of a sudden they hit a lake, you know, it really slows things down.
Full of walleye.
Yeah, exactly. Full of walleye and pike minnows and all kinds of other fish that weren't originally there that want to eat you. Yeah, and then you got turbines to contend with and, you know, the impacts of
which, like, mechanically kill the fish. I mean, like, meaning, like, smack them in the head.
Well, it's, you know, I don't, they're not, it's not, plenty of fish pass through them and live, but, and this is more Pacific Northwest type stuff, and it's not really my area, but
yeah, you guys don't have any major
no dams. We don't have big hydro projects here. No, there's one that's kicked around once in a while on the Susitna River, but no, it's not. Yeah, we're sort of lagging behind you guys.
I'm hoping you don't catch up.
Yeah, yeah,
but like, so why are kings okay? Is the future bright for pink salmon?
Yeah. You know, pink salmon being so short-lived, they're quite adaptable. They're a little bit weedy. You know, I don't think anyone's numbers are really high right now.
But why are kings then? Like, why are kings so screwed? Like, what is their Achilles heel?
So yeah,
like you never hear any good news about kings.
Yeah. So
it's like river system after river system. It's like there's fewer. They're not as big. Fewer, they're not as big.
Yeah, yeah. So the king salmon have been trending downward in size for decades.
Decades,
yeah. And
do you feel that it's human causes?
This size selective harvest probably plays a role in that. Yeah, there's a fair bit of speculation about what's driving that. It's probably not any one thing. But people have been harvesting salmon for a long time, and it's non-random. And so, yeah, selectively harvesting larger individuals is going to drive down size. Yeah. So that's probably part of it. Changes in ocean productivity, food resources at sea, that sort of things probably also plays a role.
So, like, general overfishing in the seas could be that.
Overfishing is sort of a separate issue, you know. That's taking so many that they can't replace themselves, right? But this is sort of fishing in a non-random way, right? You're selectively harvesting the larger or faster growing individuals, and you're sort of left with the.
But what about the food aspect?
If so, yeah, king salmon, I mentioned earlier that they feed a little bit more coastally. They're a little bit more of a cold adapted salmon. They're in deeper water. They're in colder water. They're feeding in a sort of a different food web than the other salmon. They tend to be more at the surface, more offshore. And yeah, it's possible that the changing climate patterns and ocean circulation patterns have affected their food resources in a way that hasn't impacted the resources of the other species.
Am I right in saying that they're just kind of screwed? Is that true or not true?
I don't know. I mean, there's a long history of salmon, you know, having problems and bouncing back. You know,
there is.
And
what's an example of a salmon that had a problem and bounced back?
Oh, there, you know, look at any run within Alaska. There are periods of low productivity and periods of high productivity. It happens in lots of places.
So you think that the problem with kings, like if you just like sort of like, I go beyond casual, but I take in news about fish. I have it selected for my personal news feed, the fisheries.
Yeah.
I'm always reading like really bad stuff about kings. Could it wind up being that in 10 years we're like, man, did we have a rough stretch?
Yes.
Really?
It very well could. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's probably related to ocean conditions. And, you know, there are these regime shifts and things that occur that can't begin to understand the physics behind them. But there are these regime shifts that change in the ocean. And it's like throwing a switch and all of a sudden things just turn around. It's possible that could happen, or it's possible that...
I mean, like El Nino, La Nina type activity.
Exactly. Exactly. Or it's possible that somehow we've... you know, affected the fish or their habitat in a way that they're not compatible with it anymore. Only time will tell. Go ahead.
No, finish up.
Oh, I was just gonna say there are you know, certainly examples of fish having, you know, potentially prolonged periods of low productivity that all of a sudden something changes and they turn it around.
Snap it around.
But you know, Alaska has, here we have the benefit that our you know, our sort of freshwater river habitat is really intact. Most of it is in really good condition, and that gives them a lot of resilience that they don't have in other places.
You mentioned something to me before that I've mentioned a couple times since you told me about it. We were talking about conservation, wildlife conservation, and you were saying how, just in speaking in a general sense, not applied to any particular species, but you're saying the conservation is such a different thing in the lower 48, where you guys have been in recovery mode for so long.
Yeah.
And in Alaska, it's more like you're not really in a recovery mode. You're almost in a descriptive mode up here.
Yeah, and conserving mode. We're trying to learn from the lessons of the lower 48. Yeah.
Like, what exactly did those guys do down there to screw their salmon up so bad?
And how can we avoid making the same mistakes? Yeah, yeah. It's interesting, too. A lot of the conservation efforts here, too, and I think it's a worthwhile endeavor, but they're trying to, like, foster a relationship between Alaskans and salmon, or to strengthen that relationship, to make, like, salmon, like, a real cultural touchstone here, so that people are more inclined to want to protect. So
everybody gives
salmon
a
habitat.
Shit about it. Not yeah, just
exactly.
Anglers.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. I think that's effort well spent.
Just to increase the cultural awareness.
Yeah.
Cultural exactly. Value.
Yep. Yep.
To make it be that it's more valuable than
everybody
gold.
Cares.
It's more valuable than gold, or more valuable than.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, and part of that's just pointing out how economically and culturally they are important, and part of it is trying to, you know, strengthen relationships that people have. And there's a lot of people moving in and out of Alaska all the time. And, you know, a huge part of our population is somewhat transient, but getting those people connected to salmon.
What was it that caused, what was the thinking that led people to want to start beginning to introduce salmon into the Great Lakes where we grew up?
Oh, so in terms of the steelhead, I think that was largely a sport fish. That was the first of the salmon to be introduced, and that was in the late 1800s.
They tried steelhead first.
To my knowledge, they may have tried other salmon that didn't take, but steelhead were introduced in...
They got them to go quick.
They're from California steelhead stock, and they introduced them in the late 1800s. And yeah, and there was a lot of kind of hatchery production keeping that propped up, but I think that there are some self-supporting populations there. But the Pacific salmon, Chinook salmon were introduced, what, late 60s?
Yeah, I don't know. The chronology was weird. It's not really the main point I wanted to ask you about. But
yeah, the motivation was that, the Great Lakes had been sort of taken over by one wave after another of invasive species. And the alewife was one that was introduced via the sort of Welland Shipping Canal that came in from the Atlantic coast into the Great Lakes. And its population had exploded by the, I guess, late 60s, maybe early 70s. And the state of Michigan, to my knowledge, stocked the Chinook salmon in an attempt to get something to eat all those alewives up. Do you remember dead alewives when we were kids?
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Like, just carpeting the beaches. It was like national news stories about all the dead alewives. And I know that they tried multiple times to get various fish going, but they established a pink population in the Great Lakes.
Yeah, and that was accidental. All of the pinks in the salmon in the Great Lakes came from one accidental stocking at, I think it was from an Ontario hatchery, on the Lake Huron side, and I think they were holding pink salmon at a hatchery because they were trying to introduce. If I have this right, they were trying to introduce a population on the Canadian Atlantic somewhere.
Really?
And they were holding them at a hatchery in the Great Lakes, and some escaped somehow, and that was all it took. They just adapted very, very quickly to...
In the northern waters more.
Yeah, the northern maybe half of the Great Lakes. They're a lot. They moved... You know, from their point of release, they were establishing runs in nearby streams, you know, pretty quickly, and they spread around the upper Great Lakes.
Does it make sense now that, so they have, they've got Chinooks or kings in the Great Lakes.
Yeah.
There's cohos in the Great Lakes. There's steelhead in the Great Lakes. Does it make sense that they were, that would you look now, know what you now know, and say, oh, yeah, of course sockeyes and chums aren't going to work in the Great Lakes?
You know, no, I think that's kind of hard to predict. It's sometimes they take and sometimes they don't. And there's a bit of a history of people trying to move salmon around, you know. But yeah, I don't know if anyone would be able to guess as to whether or not they would take or not. But yeah, I know sockeye have been tried in the Great Lakes. They didn't take. Coho, I'm not even sure that they're self-sustaining anywhere there.
It's hatchery runs.
I think so. But man, that's another world.
There's a book that I have called Fishing the Great Lakes, and it's an environmental history of the Great Lakes, and it gets into the collapse of the native fisheries.
Mm-hmm.
And then just that long history of people trying to make up for it.
Yeah.
By rather than fixing, you know, and sometimes the problems are unfixable, but like rather than fixing the problem, let's just see if there's some other thing that might like it here.
Yeah.
As we do whatever. And like interesting things that, you know, the logging boom where they were, you know, logging off the Great Lakes states and rafting all those logs out in the Great Lakes and the bays and estuary areas. Or it's not estuary because it's not salt water, but the river mouths.
River mouths, yeah.
And all the bark, when you're floating logs, the bark eventually falls away from the tree. And that you have spawning areas that were covered in 12, 15 feet of bark. Destroying fisheries, and then overfishing, destroying fisheries. Then later, people being like, "Well, let's try maybe a salmon like it." I don't know, you know.
Yeah,
and on to the point where they introduced the common carp, alewives, smelt.
Well, carp was intentional. Others weren't.
Yeah, the carp was intentional.
Yeah,
brown trout.
Yeah,
rainbow trout. Almost like in some ways, like some of the biggest like ticket fish items in the Great Lakes.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And I don't know how widely understood it is by people that live in those areas, the extent to which their lakes have become sort of an experimental aquarium.
Yeah.
And I don't know if people make like a value judgment about it.
We sure didn't growing up.
The coolest fish you could catch was a big king.
Yeah.
I was going to say, it's one when we talked, who do we talk to about that, about how it's just like the baseline that you're used to.
The shifting
baselines.
Baselines.
So that's what you came into, and so it's fine.
But yeah, but if you were out trolling for Kings and you caught a Laker, people would be like, oh, Laker.
Greaseball.
Yeah, greaseball. So that's like the native fish, which kind of like built this state, man. And there was like a thriving commercial industry around that fish and all this history. And the Native Americans that lived here would like lived off that fish and relied on it. And it becomes where it comes up and you're like, duh, I was hoping for the one that came on a truck and got dumped out of a, I was hoping for the one that got dumped out of a barrel.
You know, I was talking to some biologists from the Great Lakes recently, and I was pleasantly surprised to learn that the stars have sort of realigned for lake trout, and they're having a bit of a comeback now, the native lake trout in the Great Lakes. That was nice to hear.
Perception-wise?
No, population-wise. Oh, right? I think perception-wise, too. I think they're a little more valued now than they used to be.
What other... If Kings are down right now, Pinks are up right now.
Everything else is up.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Numbers are great. Like the populations are.
So it might not be that we just broke something that we won't be able to fix. It might be that like Kings, I mean, some rivers we just broke, right?
Oh yeah. Like, I mean, yeah, a lot of them, Columbia, Sacramento. Yeah.
Just that this broke. Is there a way, I know this isn't your business, but like, do you think that there's a way that, to turn around some of the broke systems, particularly in like some of the rivers that are so busted in California?
Oh man, there's a whole lot of people working on that. Yeah, you should talk to one of them.
Yeah, because up here, man, it's like there's like seems to be like a general optimism about salmon.
Well, I mean, yeah, they're at historic. Sort of a high point in their abundance right now. The last couple decades have been great for salmon in general, with the exception of Chinook having sort of a 10-year slump in productivity. Yeah.
Let's say something happened and the oceans got a degree or two warmer. Would that shift open up a lot of habitat to salmon that they're not currently using because it's too cold? Like, would the whole show just kind of move north? Or are there reasons that it wouldn't work like that?
Ask an oceanographer. I think there are fish running rivers further north now, like into Arctic Alaska and presumably Arctic Canada.
That maybe didn't have runs in the past.
Yep.
But see, that gets into another question I wanted to ask you. But expound on that for a minute, and then I'm going to ask you another question.
Fish or salmon are certainly, you know, moving further north into the Bering Sea and beyond. But I don't think you can assume that you know, just given the shape of that basin, right? You're losing if you just shift the entire envelope of salmon further north, you have a lot less habitat to work with.
I mean, because it shrinks as it gets north.
Yeah.
But the idea that they shift, like you could have a northern river that right now doesn't get fish and it's just too cold or whatever.
Yeah.
So let's say there was this idea that a river would have fish turn up in it. That brings up a really interesting question, is that their fidelity to their home stream must not be entirely strict.
It's not absolute, no.
Because how would a fish ever find a new river has to go back to where he was born?
I mean, go back 15,000 years and... You know, most of Alaska salmon habitat was under ice.
So what accounts for that? That's a good point. So during all the different glacial periods, yeah, there was no salmon run because it was just...
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, built into their sort of life history is a certain propensity for a small number of individuals to go to the wrong river.
What percent do they know?
Oh, it's small, and it varies by species, and it varies by it's an adaptive trait. It's sort of bred into the system, you know.
Oh, it's great that some of them would make a mistake.
Oh yeah, it makes perfect sense. It allows for a little genetic mixing among population, and allows for colonization of new habitats. So yeah, it's built into their life history.
Do you remember in Sault Ste. Marie? So I'm going to paint this picture for the listeners in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. You have the St. Mary's River drains Lake Superior, and it falls, I think, 22 feet. or 18 feet or something 14, like that.
14 something. Yeah.
Falls some number of feet, more than 10, through the Sioux Rapids. And then the St. Mary's River flows down after draining Lake Superior, flows down the St. Mary's River and flows into Lake Huron. In Sault Ste. Marie, there's a hydroelectric project where they cut a channel to funnel some of that water that's coming down the St. Mary's to flow through a hydroelectric canal that then goes out and pushes a bunch of electric turbines. So it's like they chiseled off a branch of the stream to power an hydroelectric dam.
Yeah, it goes from above the falls, loops around, and it dumps them below the falls.
Yeah, they're capitalizing on that, whatever it is.
I think it's 14 feet.
14 to 18, 20, whatever the hell number of feet it is. It capitalizes on that fall to get a good head of water going to push, to turn the turbines in a dam. And this dam has a bunch of turbines, but some of the turbines have, were given over to a fish lab. You know where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
And all the turbines or tunnels would have names, and there's one through whatever the hell.
Yeah.
And they would rear Atlantics as a part of this experimental project to like establish Atlantics in the Great Lakes. They would rear Atlantics in a certain tunnel. I think it was number one.
Yeah, it's on that end of the building, yeah.
And you could go there, and we would go there to fish whitefish, and you could go and look, and you could just see the Atlantics that were returning, and they would return to the fish lab. Do you remember this?
Yeah, they'd return to that tunnel. I mean, they'd nose into a lot of those tunnels, but they would liked
look, the
yeah.
one that they were coming from. You would look in the like wait, there'd be like 10 in that one, 3 in the next one,
yeah,
and then maybe like 1 in the next one. And you can sort of see like how good they were at hitting the right spot, whatever they were smelling or keying
off. Oh, yeah, it's scent, yeah.
And then there was some other ones who were like close but not quite.
Yeah, yeah.
Shifting around down there. Yeah, these things are separated by yards.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. No, that they there's a window of time when those salmon are young where they sort of memorize or imprint the scent of their stream, and that's all. That's the last, you know, bit of migrating they do. They're doing it by their nose.
What's the first bit of migrating they do?
Oh, it's sort of like I don't understand biologically how it works, but it's sort of like a they're triangulating their position based on like sun angle and magnetism and things like that. So they have sort of a, think of it as like a mental map, and they're using that to get in the rough vicinity, and then at some point their nose more or less takes over.
So if you went out on the high, is it believed that if you went out on the high seas, okay, you have a salmon that came out of a specific river, so it came out of the Kenai River, and he's out on the high seas, and you went and caught him and blindfolded him, and then heli lifted him 2 miles and put him back in the ocean. Do you feel like he'd turn up at the same river?
Oh, well.
Because you can't be backtracking.
Oh, where did you catch him?
I'm just saying, you pick him out of the high seas somewhere and blindfold him.
On the middle of the ocean.
And move him 100 miles.
Oh. But then you unblindfold him.
Then you unblindfold him, put him back in the
river. He's going to have no problem.
So it's not like he remembers his route.
No.
It's something else.
No, he has like he has some way of fixing his position on a mental map. Yeah.
Man, are we studying that right now? That how they...
A lot of work has been done on this. Yeah,
I read about the magnetism stuff, and
yeah,
it's fascinating, man.
You know, on the
they work on it with turtles a lot.
Oh, okay.
That's how cool. Do those turtles know to find that beach?
You know, on the scent end, there were some cool studies done in the Great Lakes back. I want to say 60s or maybe 70s, probably when they were first introducing salmon there. But they held these young salmon. I think they held them in a stream, and they dripped some certain chemical in that stream, and those salmon imprinted on that smell, and they released those salmon and let them roam around the Great Lakes for a couple years. And when that salmon were maturing and coming back, they went like a few miles down the beach and dripped that same chemical into the wrong stream, and all the salmon went to the wrong stream where the chemical is being dripped.
So when they're closing in,
they just pick up that scent and follow it in. Yeah.
Dude, it blows your mind.
Yeah, how can it be so unique, each area, you know?
Oh, but you figure all the different ions, you know, dissolve all the different types of ions from all the different rocks and soil and everything in that water. It's like they have this whole portfolio of concentrations, and like they just learn that smell, you know?
Can you real quick talk about, this is the last thing I have you explain. Can you talk about the function of moving marine resources? How a salmon is a mechanism that moves marine resources inland?
Yeah. They're a sort of vector to move energy and nutrients up rivers. Like we said earlier, in high latitudes, fresh waters are much less productive than ocean waters, and salmon do this cool trick where they go out to the sea, and it's not intentional, it's just a byproduct of their life history, but they go out to sea and they put on a bunch of weight, and then they swim, you know, upstream and bring with them all of this fat and protein and phosphorus and nitrogen and all these different forms of fertilizer that the fish that rear in those streams and the insects and the algae. And so they're sort of fertilizing that stream.
Feeding bears, feeding birds.
Yeah. And that river is, you know, it's flowing, it's spending all of its time taking nutrients from the landscape and bringing them out to the ocean. And then salmon sort of reverse that flow once a year and bring in, you know, in cases with big runs, many, many tons of nutrients back to the land. Yeah, and it has a lot of sort of feedbacks within the ecosystem in terms of feeding.
So, do you feel that there's probably places where if you eliminated the salmon, you could feasibly trigger a sort of ecological collapse?
Yeah, it would certainly be bad for, you know, large, you know, mobile consumers that move around and eat salmon, like bears and, you know, eagles and other scavengers. Yeah. And it's, some of the work that I've been involved with has shown that juvenile salmon that are exposed to large volumes of salmon, eggs, and other types of resources will grow faster than those that don't have access to as much, you know, salmon eggs and flesh and other marine resources. And there's a lot of literature out
there. The juveniles are eating are directly feeding off the carcasses of the grown.
Yeah, the carcasses and the eggs, you know. And yeah, there's been a whole lot of work in different places around Alaska looking at different aspects of this. But, like for instance, out in Bristol Bay in southwest Alaska, where, you know, there are trophy rainbow populations out there that are fished by anglers from all over the world, you know, from they're staying at high-end lodges, and it's one of Alaska's sort of premier trophy sport fisheries. But those trophy rainbow trout out there get, you know, a huge fraction of their annual nutritional intake just by eating salmon eggs. It's a huge diet item for them. And it comes in a pretty short period of time, you know. It's our late summer, early fall. They're getting most of their caloric intake for the whole year.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Then they just chill out.
Just chill out. Water gets cold, their metabolism slows down, and they just kind of hang on to that weight, you know, until the next year.
Yanni, you got more questions?
When those salmon are out in the ocean, I believe there's a term for this, for two different types of fish out in the ocean, ones that are just like constantly moving and constantly eating. Versus one that actually has a resting time. You understand my question?
Yeah.
And it kind of changes the flesh too, right? The type of flesh.
Has. But salmon are all on the same page with
right,
that.
Right, they They're, are. Yeah, they are. Yeah. But what's that called?
Oh, like a... I mean, yeah, like a cruising pelagic fish. They're mobile. They're always swimming.
They never go down to the bottom and sit there.
No, they're not going to go down like a halibut or a rockfish and hang out on the bottom. Yeah, but they're a roving epipelagic predator. Yeah,
and he's just eating just constantly. I mean, it's just like that's his.
Oh, I'm sure they slack off at certain times, but yeah, I mean they're an actively swimming mobile fish.
They never sleep like how we perceive of sleep.
Huh?
No, I'm asking.
Oh, I thought you were making a statement because this is something I never really looked into. Yeah.
But I mean, they never go, they can't go like lay down.
I guess you're right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like when we used to go out as kids gigging frogs? I shouldn't say this because now we know you're not supposed to do it, but you can't do it with the you're not supposed to gig frogs in Michigan with artificial light. But we would go out with artificial lights, remember?
Yeah.
To look for bullfrogs and, well, crayfish. That's perfectly legal. We'd go out to do that, and you'd catch bluegills. We're like, that bluegill is asleep.
Yeah. Yeah.
You'd catch bluegills just like completely zoned out. You'd almost like walk up and grab them.
Yeah. You know, I around the shack, I have seen salmon where they're sitting at the surface still with their fins out of the water sometimes.
Oh, really? Holding still.
I don't. Maybe that's sleeping. Yeah.
But they are. They tend to use the top of the water, the lit version of the water.
Oh, yeah. Even when they're out at in the middle of the ocean, yeah, they're just using the top of the water column. Yeah.
Not down deep. Dirt, final questions?
I got a couple, actually.
Lay it on me, man.
So finning, I did a little purse seining years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And we'd always sit around in a finning group and jumpers.
Oh, yeah.
And what's the purpose of both of those when they're kind of like close to a...
Oh, like what are they accomplishing with that behavior?
I mean, when they're all pooled up with their fins out of the water, yeah. And what are they doing when they jump?
Yeah, and like I've heard various opinions of what they're trying to do.
Oh, I don't even have one. Yeah, you know it's a fascinating behavior.
You know what one of the things people say?
What?
Loosening
eggs. That it loosens their eggs up.
Oh. No, not I mean, how do you answer that question, I guess? Yeah. No, it's cool to be around that. When you really know that there's... It's cool to be around all that life, you know?
Yeah.
You can just look out there and see salmon fins sticking up out of the water, and there's jumpers everywhere, and there's...
You know it's way larger below too.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
But is that them just...
It's like seeing an iceberg float there. You're not, all you're seeing is the...
Yeah.
So there's not a good theory about why salmon...
Oh, somebody might have one. I just don't. Yeah.
It's not a tested theory.
Yeah, I think it's a difficult one to test.
And then the other one... I really want to ask about the burbot leech, but that wouldn't make sense at all.
We caught a burbot with a parasite on it. Looked like a leech.
Oh, probably was.
Oh, okay.
Cool.
I mean, I know there's leeches around. Yeah.
And then one more, and this one's a little more philosophical. There may not be an answer to it, but just because you've had as a fish biologist, that intimate relationship with each species, do you find yourself prone to be particular to one of those five that we talked about in your region of study?
Oh,
or is that not a fair question?
No, professionally, I really like ho-ho because they're just everywhere and they're abundant and they live in fresh water a long time and I work in fresh water. And I think they're a super cool fish, but...
Cool. And that's prioritized over like the angling of them or eating of them. It's like their activity as a species.
Oh, it all works together. You know, I have a thing for coho, and part of
it's like coho's got like mooch and coho.
Yeah, exactly.
The one I root for, man.
Yeah, angling and my professional life all sort of get intertwined. You know, but yeah, I really do. I really do have a thing for. I really love catching kings too. I'm fascinated by them, and it's just a huge accomplishment to me to catch one of those things, especially out in salt water. I love it.
Here's my. Is that cool on you?
Yeah, it's great.
Okay, I got one last thing I forgot to ask about. This is going to suffice as my concluder. Then you can do a concluder if you want. You told me an interesting thing one time where you're saying that it's possible to have, or it's maybe possible, or it's an idea that could be entertained, that it's possible to have too many fish go up a river.
Yeah.
Because you would think, like, the more fish, the better. Like, bring them on up the river. But there's a point at which you might get, like, a diminishing returns. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah.
I don't know if this is more of a theoretical concept or if it has, like
No, it has some
applicable.
It has some application, and there's some data behind it. But, you know, in terms of the bears and the eagles, you know, there can't be too many salmon.
Yep.
But, yeah, so... that's actually a really big can of worms you just opened, so I'm not sure exactly where to start with this, but
can I tell you what I understood you to be saying?
No. Go ahead.
Okay, we were out one time. I don't know, I was just hanging around with you, and we were doing some work, and we were out checking minnow traps. I think you were like, we were out checking minnow traps because you were out trapping baby cohos in a river.
Yeah, I remember this.
And you were looking at things of like how what's the density?
Yeah.
And what's the tolerance of competition?
Yeah.
Of cohos when they're spending all this time, when they're spending these 2 years in the stream where they were born. And you were saying that, you were talking about this idea that it could be that you could have less coho babies in the river, but they're all so much more healthier because they're not suffering from too much competition. And you could have been like trying an idea out.
No. Said,
and maybe like sending out 50 that are super fit and had like a great resource of food could in the end be better than
sending out 200 emaciated.
200 emaciated oh, fish sure. that weren't doing good.
Yeah. So, yeah.
That you'd wind up with a better, healthier return.
Yes. So, you know, a river of any size has a finite amount of spawning and rearing habitat. And so when you get to a point where there are, if you have an exceptionally large run and lots and lots of spawners, you get into a position where you have a wave of fish come in, they start building nests, they spawn there, and then the next wave of fish comes in, digs all those nests up, lays more nests on top of them, right? And so only the last batch of fish that spawn there are going to really have any output, right? You had a lot of excess. I mean,
so they could excavate and destroy each other's nests.
Yeah. And in the trade, they call it nest superimposition. They're just building nests on top of other nests. And the thought is that you could have harvested a lot of those fish without having any negative impact on the return. But the same thing plays out too in the rearing habitat, especially for those fish, the species that rear in freshwater, right? So if you have way too many, and I struggle with the term too many.
I'm already seeing where I messed it up.
So if you have a really large sockeye run and you have a lot of spawners that are all producing fry that are then migrating to a rearing lake, and the lake has sort of the scenario that you're describing with the coho a minute ago. You have a huge biomass, a huge number of juveniles there, and the per capita food resources then are low, and there's a lot of competition, and you know those fish can't all get big, right? So yeah, so that's kind of how salmon are managed in Alaska and elsewhere. They take a long time series of data where for a given river, they observe how many salmon are going in that river to spawn, and then from that given brood year and subsequent years, how many salmon come back. And so for every spawning run, they calculate how many subsequent returns were produced. And over a long period of time, you can sort of develop this empirical relationship between the number of spawners that you let into a river and the number of salmon that come back later from those spawners.
I understand now where I was messing it
up. At least in theory, you'll see sort of, you know, that relationship. If you picture a graph with, you know, the number of spawners on the x-axis, you know, at low numbers of spawners, you're going to get a lot of returns, right? But that levels off eventually. At some point, you can put more spawners into the system, but you don't get back a lot of fish because of competition for nests and competition for food and that sort of thing.
So you might be looking at a river thinking, we're going to have, let's just use simple numbers, 100 fish are going to come back up here next year. And we might be able to harvest half of all the fish that come up, and you're still going to have 100 come back or some such.
Yeah, and that's a good rule of thumb, actually. Like in most of Alaska's fisheries, I think over the long term, about, you know, maybe 40 to 60% of the returning adults, and these things only spawn once, so they're being harvested before they ever have a chance to spawn. But every single year, every single run, you know, about, you know, roughly half, give or take, of the population is killed before it has a chance to spawn. But that's sort of a testament to the productivity of these fish, because this has been going on, you know, in Alaska for over 100 years in most places, and those fish just keep coming back and coming back. And they're, you know, they're at, you know, populations are, for the most part, doing great, you know.
So I'm so happy to hear the salmon are doing all right, yeah. Generally. It's, I mean, up here at least.
Yeah. Yeah. Pacific Northwest is a bit of another story, but
dude,
yeah.
It's a totally different story.
Wasn't there a closure on king fishing to retain the...
Oh, there's a lot of that going around. Yeah.
I mean, last year, I remember specifically when we were out at your guys'
because
cabin.
They couldn't tell, because there's kings up here that belong down there.
Yeah, it was something like that.
They didn't
that.
Want them getting... There's so few down there, they didn't want whatever ones might happen to be running around up here
yeah.
getting killed, and they might be turning up down there later.
That seemed very...
Am I getting that right?
Odd.
Well, the sport and commercial seasons were closed for king salmon in southeast Alaska starting in August
yep.
last year. There are a handful of the transboundary rivers in southeast Alaska, like the Stikine and the Taku and the Yunik, rivers that drain from British Columbia into mainland southeast Alaska. The king salmon runs in all those rivers are in pretty bad shape right now. And so they closed the fisheries in southeast
to maximize return.
Oh.
Yes, yes. And a lot of those fish feed sort of locally. So, you know, even by the time August came around last year, most of that year's spawners were already, or if not all of them, already in the river. But I think that they were closing that to preserve, you know, immature fish feeding
you.
In that sort of coastal southeast.
And that alludes to that sort of Canada-U.S. interplay of salmon management.
Yeah, there are some treaties on those rivers, too, I believe.
Yeah, like just because it flows out in your country doesn't mean that you can...
Run the show, yeah.
You can run the show when we need to have our fish cross the border and come back
yeah.
up to where
yeah,
we're
Yeah, there's at. A lot of habitat in Canada, yeah.
All right, do you have any things that you wanted to wedge in that we didn't get to?
No, I had a list, but we got to them, yeah.
Really? Where's your list?
Well, in my head.
Oh, you had a mental. And you guys are good?
Yeah.
Awesome. Ready for a taco.
Fish taco?
What kind of tacos we have?
Moose, but we do have some a little bit of halibut and rockfish we could heat up, though. Left over from a couple nights ago.
No salmon?
Nope. Man, I got very little salmon left in the freezer, man. I like to have that stuff gone.
You got to get it gone, man.
Yeah.
You can sit on a piece of deer meat for a couple years, but salmon, I like to get it in and out.
Yes.
In and out. Same here. All right. Thanks for joining.